Welcome to the MacArthur Memorial Podcast, where we explore the life and times of General of the Army Douglas MacArthur and delve into the history of World War I, World War II, and the Korean War. We invite you to follow us on Twitter at MacArthur1880 or find the General Douglas MacArthur Memorial on Facebook. To commemorate the 75th anniversary of the Battle of Midway, the MacArthur Memorial, the Hampton Roads Naval Museum, and the Virginia World War I and World War II Commemoration Commission hosted a series of lectures about the Battle of Midway. Elliot Carlson, author of Joe Rochefort's War, spoke about U.S. Navy code breaking prior to the Battle of Midway.
My theme today, Midway and code breaking, when cryptanalysis came of age, might need a bit of an explanation. It suggests that there was a time before Midway when cryptanalysis was not of age. And this might seem odd because cryptanalysis, the art of breaking secret messages encrypted in a cipher or code, has a long history. It goes back to the Romans. During World War I, the British Navy stymied the German high seas fleet using code breaking. But on the eve of World War II, as practiced by the American Army and Navy, cryptanalysis was barely in its adolescence. The American military had barely entered the cryptologic arena no more than 20 years earlier. And for many officers, admirals, generals, this activity was new. It was not only new, it was strange and a little fuzzy. A lot of them regarded cryptanalysis as a kind of novelty, a activity that would probably never yield timely intelligence in a combat situation. So cryptanalysis was not really much of a magnet for ambitious young officers. In fact, the field was considered a career killer, and only a few very intrepid souls wanted to have anything to do with it. The way to get ahead in the Navy was to join the gun club, adopt a specialty in gunnery, and that was the way to rise in the Navy. Codebreakers, the reputation of cryptanalysis wasn't helped by the attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941. A lot of the skeptics in the officer ranks wondered why this new science hadn't provided a better warning. So cryptanalysis entered World War II very much under a cloud. Codebreakers had staggering problems of their own besides their reputation. Their big problem was that there wasn't enough of them. Both services had too few trained cryptanalysts. The Navy did have around 50 in its Washington office, but a lot of them were detailed to work on various codes, diplomatic codes, Enigma, the German Enigma code. Only a tiny handful worked on the Imperial Navy operational code. And this small group was supplemented by 21 cryptanalysts scattered across the Pacific in the Navy's two field stations at Pearl Harbor in Manila. And this small band was charged with shadowing the entire Japanese Navy. It must be said, they did an amazing job. They did catch a few breaks. Walter Bornman was talking about the early raids in the Gilbert and Marshall Islands and the Solomons, Owen Stanley. Well, code breakers can't break codes unless they have intercepts, lots of messages to work with. And those raids generated gazillions of Imperial Navy messages. So suddenly our code breakers had more intercepts than they knew what to do with than they could possibly break. And that showed in the results that came later when a Japanese squadron was spotted heading towards Port Moresby on the southern coast of New Guinea. It was tracked by analysts at Pearl Harbor and at Melbourne, Australia, and that's to where the Manila group had been evacuated early in the war. Admiral Nimitz now had information, and he sent the carriers Lexington and Yorktown to that region to thwart that Japanese advance and the resulting action known as the Battle of the Coral Sea, about which we heard earlier, was really the first major setback for the Imperial Navy. It's been called a draw. I think that I would say it was a tactical draw or a tactical win for the Japanese, but a strategic defeat for the Japanese because they weren't able to proceed with their mission. But it was at Midway Atoll, a month later on June 4, where cryptanalysis comes into its own. In the words of historian John Ferris, Midway is one of those cases when intelligence strikes like lightning. At Midway, Navy cryptanalysts demonstrated their ability to affect the outcome of a fateful campaign. Midway was the crucial battle of the Pacific War, Nimitz said. That engagement made everything else possible. I think it's no exaggeration to say that aside from the Battle of the Coral Sea, the Battle of Midway was the only campaign of the Pacific War in which code breaking was so fundamental to the event that if there had been no code breaking, there would have been no battle. The battle could not have happened without it. Without code breaking, June 4 would have been a very different day from the day that history recorded. True, some things would have been the same. Isoroku Yamamoto's striking force, the famed Kitubute, four fast carriers, would still have converged on Midway Atoll. But the three carriers that Nimitz had available to check that advance, Yorktown, Enterprise, and Hornet, they would not have been there. Yorktown would have been 3,000 miles away in the Bremerton shipyard, getting repairs from scars sustained in the Coral Sea. Enterprise and Hornet would have been 4,000 miles away on station in the Coral Sea, and that is where Admiral King wanted them to be, to give protection to Australia. Australia had been pleading with King that they needed extra protection from the Japanese fleet, and the Australians were very worried about the Japanese Navy. So you had those three carriers all in the wrong place. There were no carriers in the Central Pacific. So both those carriers, the Hornet and the Enterprise, cruised in the Coral Sea on May 16. But just 17 days later, moving at breakneck speed by Navy standards, all three carriers, including Yorktown, showed up 200 miles northeast of Midway at a point that Nimitz called Point Luck. What caused Nimitz to act so quickly was a single message, a single transmission from Imperial Navy headquarters to a Japanese transport ship resting in the Marshalls called the Gosho Maru. And the Gosho Maru was asked to go to Saipan, pick up supplies, and proceed to a place called AF. I'll talk more about AF later. That dispatch picked up by station HIPO radio men on Oahu, decrypted by codebreakers at Pearl, left no doubts in Nimitz's mind that Yamamoto planned to invade and occupy Midway Atoll. Now, General George Marshall, the Army's chief of staff, said the closest squeak and the greatest victory in the Pacific was at Midway. Marshall's appraisal of Midway is now widely accepted. What isn't so well known is that lightning almost didn't strike on June 4. The battle as we know it almost didn't happen. Marshall called Midway a close squeak, but it wasn't only a close squeak in the waters near Midway. It was also a close squeak in Washington, where Army and Navy chieftains couldn't agree among themselves where Yamamoto would strike his blow, and they disputed and rejected Nimitz's estimate. Nimitz at first was unfazed by this squabble that was going on. He felt comfortable with his order because the information he acted upon had been conveyed by a source that he had learned to trust. And this source was a prickly and sometimes difficult intelligence officer named Joe Rochefort. Rochefort is easily the pivotal character of this story. He was an unusual officer. Unlike most officers occupying positions of high responsibility in the Navy, he had not been to the Naval Academy. He had come up from enlisted ranks This made him something of an oddity in the Navy's class-conscious culture. He was an independent cuss. The historian Walter Lord described Rochefort as caustic, witty, unorthodox, blunt but quick, intimate and brilliant. Quirky as Rochefort may have been, Nemitz's faith in this officer was well placed. Rochefort had been a pioneer in Navy cryptology. He entered the field in 1925, joining something that was then called, euphemistically, the research desk. The word was intended to disguise one of the Navy's newest activities at that time, code breaking. When the founder of the research desk, a cryptanalytic genius named Lawrence Safford, rotated to sea duty, Rochefort inherited his job. So at the tender age of 26, and with only a couple of months of training under his belt, Rochefort found himself running the Navy's code-breaking arm. It consisted of five people, one officer, himself, and four civilians. Now, happily, one of those civilians was an experienced cryptanalyst, the brilliant, if somewhat haughty, Agnes Meyer Driscoll, known as Miss Aggie. Miss Aggie tutored Joe in the abstruse field of cryptanalysis. They worked together a lot for about a year and a half or 2 years, and they did actually, working together, compromise at least one Imperial Navy code. Miss Aggie went on to become one of the Navy's legendary cryptanalysts and teachers, and Joe went to Japan. He was ordered there by Naval Intelligence to learn the language and familiarize himself with the culture and the people of Japan, and he, staying there 3 years, that's what he did. So in the spring of 1941, with war looking more likely in the Far East, Rochefort's training in cryptology in Japan and training in Japanese came in handy. His old boss, Lawrence Safford, now ran something called UP-20G. UP-20G was an expansion of the old research. It was a new version of the Navy's original code-breaking arm. Safford wanted Rochefort to run UP-20G's field station at Pearl Harbor. Joe took the job, and this unit later gained fame as Station Hypo. Rochefort did not personally break Imperial Navy codes, or at least he didn't do it all by himself. He had a lot of help. He used his expertise in the language and cryptology to lead the team that did most of that work. His outfit consisted of about a small corps of about two dozen officers and enlisted men. These gentlemen were a motley crew, a salty mixture of cryptanalysts, math wizards, language officers, and cryptologic mavens. By Rochefort's definition, they were odd characters. They were people who, in Rochefort's words, will not generally conform to accepted ideas. Rochefort met this as a compliment. As he put it, if you desire to be a real great cryptanalyst, being a little bit nuts helps. Well, Rochefort's odd characters did their work in a rather dreary place, a drab, windowless basement in the Navy's administration building at Pearl Harbor. This is what it looked like in 1942, and it's what it looks like today. That little space there is the door that led down to this work area, this basement work area. This is the staircase that led down to it, and it was usually full of burn bags from discarded intercepts and worksheets. So getting down there was kind of a trial, not an inspiring place. And because Rochefort wouldn't allow photographers down there for security reasons, all we have is this artist's conception. The basement was fairly spacious, about the size of a large pool hall, but it had some drawbacks. The air conditioner either whirred excessively or didn't whir at all, so you were either hot or too cold, and or you sometimes froze your bones off, and the men down there called that place the dungeon. We have one other idea of that world I must share with you. It comes by way of Hollywood. In the 1976 movie Midway, Rochefort is portrayed by actor Hal Holbrook as a kind of weirdo. a loudmouth who speaks with a folksy twang, chomps big cigars, and walks around sloppily dressed in a red smock. Rochefort's old staff hated Holbrook's portrayal of Rochefort. They said he wasn't like that at all. They remembered him as a tall, slender, aristocratic gentleman who spoke softly and smoked a pipe at his desk. It's odd they should have thought that, because Joe was actually a consultant on the movie. He was on the set almost every day and seemed to thoroughly enjoy himself. One little trouble was the movie was released July 18, 1976. The movie was released, and Joe died July 20, a month later. So whether Joe liked the movie or would have liked it, we'll probably never know. But Rochefort did wear a red smoking jacket down there in the confines of that dank basement because, as he said, it was cold down there. At first, Rochefort and his odd characters pleased their bosses in Washington. That changed after Japan's surprise attack on December 7. High Post codebreakers weren't blamed for that debacle, but Lawrence Safford he lost some stature. He lost some credibility with his higher-ups, and he was reassigned, and new bosses took over Op 20G. This was bad news for Rochefort. His new bosses in Washington didn't like his practice, whereby he customarily reported his findings, radio findings and so forth and whatnot, to the fleet commander first. That is to say, he would report first to Admiral Husband Kimball while he was there, and then Nimitz, and then only secondarily to Op 20G in Washington. John Redmond now ran Op 20G. He was a curious choice. He did have friends in high places, which may explain it, but he had no background in cryptology or code breaking or cryptanalysis. He was a proficient in regular Navy communications, which is to say hardware, Morse code, kind of regular stuff like that. But he had no background in cryptanalysis or the sub rosa part of the Navy's communication process. Well, Redmond wanted code breaking and intelligence and HIPO's findings to be centralized in Washington. They wanted Rochefort to send in HIPO's data and let Op 20G, let Washington do the thinking. Rochefort would go along with this. He thought because of his background in cryptology and the Japanese language, he was better fitted than the people in Washington to render judgment on what the Japanese intended. So he continued to report first to Fleet Headquarters. Over the weeks, the relations between Station HIPO and Op 20G frayed. The two teams spatted and sparred. But despite this bickering, they all did serious work. Along with codebreakers in Melbourne, and certainly some in Washington were doing some decent work, they confronted a daunting task: how to break the Imperial Navy's main operational code. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the famous JN-25B. The numbers on the left are five-digit code groups. The wording on the left, on the right, are plain text recoveries of those code groups. As you can see, the top code group is a dive bomber, and others have not been recovered. Some are ships, some are something else. In all, JN-25B had 50,000 five-digit code groups, and assigning values to these code groups was a gargantuan task, and it was made harder by the fact that the code groups on the left were disguised by something called additives. There was a code group or an additive book of 50,000 additives. They looked like that, superimposed upon the regular code groups. So before you could read the real code group, you had to strip off these additives. Not easy work. Unlike Enigma, the code used by the German Army and Navy, JN-25B was not a machine-encrypted code. It couldn't be decrypted by a machine. as codebreakers at Bletchley Park were able to do with Enigma. JN25B was a manual code. Each group had to be solved by paper and pencil one at a time. Still, HIPO's analysts did use some machines, collators, tabulators, other devices, to gain clues into the code. Each month, they used 3 million IBM punch cards for storage and retrieval of each portion of each five-digit code group they received. Gradually, a small but usable portion of JN25B became readable. And when they were able to read it, they saw a huge offensive building up in Japanese home waters. They knew the attack would be huge. They knew it would be bigger than the Coral Sea, but they didn't know where it would be. Now Station HIPO turned into a pressure cooker. To pinpoint the Imperial Navy's target, analysts started working long hours. Rochefort worked routinely 20-hour days. His men worked almost as many hours. Their problem wasn't breaking messages so much as it was staying awake. One HIPO analyst, actually my favorite guy at Station HIPO, Lieutenant Commander Thomas H. Dyer, suffered various ailments peculiar to codebreakers. The result was sitting long hours at a desk struggling with an intractable code. To cope with this problem, Dyer took uppers and downers. As Tommy put it years later, "I couldn't sleep, I couldn't keep awake sitting at my desk, so my doctor gave me some benzedrine sulfate. I could take that in the morning and phenobarbital at night, and that worked pretty well." Well, all this work did pay off. On May 13, HIPO's radio men intercepted that Imperial Navy message I told you about earlier that established Midway as Yamamoto's target. The message contained the geographic designator AF. Rochefort remembered that back in March, HIPO had picked up a message from a Japanese scout plane flying near Midway, and that scout plane sent a message to Wake Island using the designator AF. So AF was clearly Midway. Nobody had any doubt about that at Pearl Harbor. But when Nimitz on May 14 reported HIPO's finding to Washington, he ran into that buzzsaw I described earlier. General Marshall, General Hap Arnold, Chief of the Army Air Corps, and Secretary of War Henry Stimson all believe Yamamoto intended to hit not Midway, but the American West Coast in retaliation for the Doolittle raid that on April 18 had bombed Tokyo and four other Japanese cities, humiliating the Imperial Navy. Admiral Ernest J. King, about whom we heard from earlier, we know he was a guy who was temperamental, had a lot of anger and rage. He was mercurial. Well, he first had doubts about Midway, and so informed Nimitz. But then in 2 days later, King did something that astonished Nimitz and Nimitz's staff. King actually changed his mind, and he accepted Nimitz's assessment. Nimitz had to cajole from King the transfer of those carriers from the Coral Sea to Midway, but King went along with it. But Op 20G, this little band, this little group of cryptanalysts working separately, didn't agree with HIPO, and they told King that HIPO was making a terrible mistake, and that if King followed HIPO's lead, he would be making a terrible mistake. Op 20G's analysts actually believed that the Imperial Navy might be heading for Samoa rather than going east to Midway, or they thought perhaps Hawaii itself would be the main target. So Nimitz now was getting a little anxious himself, and he told Rochefort that he needed better proof, and Rochefort convened his group in the basement. And fortunately, there was a member of his staff named, this was King, we missed him. Jasper Holmes informed Rochefort about Midway's vulnerability to water shortages, and they thought that if they could get Midway to report a shortage, Japanese radio men would pick that up, convey it to Tokyo, and the cat would be out of the bag. It was indeed going to be Midway. Japanese radio men did take that bait, and the word got out that it was now confirmed. The late trouble was Rochefort hadn't bothered to inform his bosses in New York, in Washington, about the water ploy, and they didn't appreciate the slight, but they had no choice but to accept the final Midway estimate. By the end of May, Navy codebreakers, primarily those at Pearl Harbor and Melbourne, had decrypted so many of Yamamoto's messages that they were able to itemize almost the entire order of battle of the Japanese Armada. This is a iconic message, in my opinion. This is Nimitz's dispatch to all his commanders at sea on May 31st, 10 days after this original water ploy, showing how much he had learned from his codebreakers about what was going to happen at Midway. From this message, we can see that Nimitz had incredibly detailed information. He knew about a striking force coming in from the northwest and a number of carriers. He knew about a support force and an occupation force coming in from the west, transports and destroyers, and as many as 16 submarines. So Nimitz was really armed. And with this cornucopia of information, Nimitz proceeded with his plan to surprise the Japanese, which we all know he did. In the aftermath of that stunning victory, Rochefort should have been the man of the hour. He was in the eyes of Admiral Nimitz, and Nimitz put him in for a Distinguished Service Medal. Up 20G now exacted just a tad of revenge. They persuaded King to veto that medal, and King went with the recommendation of his staff and vetoed it. A little later, they went a step further and removed Rochefort from Pearl Harbor and had him assigned to a shipyard in San Francisco Bay, ordered to supervise the building of a floating dry dock. Floating dry dock, magnificent structures, if you ever seen one. And he did that rather well. The Navy's success, medal or no medal, Rochefort and his team put their stamp on the Battle of Midway. The amazing precision of the intelligence available to Nimitz, the enemy's objective, his strength, the timing of his attack, the direction of his approach, his launch position, all was the product of cryptanalysis. The Navy's success put cryptanalysis on the map inside the military. It gave codebreakers the recognition and respectability they needed when they needed it most. Ambitious officers caught on that they had an option, an alternative to the gun club. They had another pathway to a glorious career in the Navy. They didn't have to join, get up and be gunners. At the outset of the war, codebreaking units in the Army and Navy numbered little more than 1,000 souls, counting cryptanalysts, radio operators, crypto clerks, and miscellaneous others. By the end of the war, that number had ballooned to more than 16,000 in Washington alone. Cryptanalysis had indeed come of age. If you will indulge me a footnote, I'll have to say that in 1986, Rochefort did get his Distinguished Service Medal at the behest of his staff. They campaigned for years and years and years, and finally it worked, and President Reagan awarded Joe the medal. Joe couldn't be there himself because he had died 10 years earlier. So the medal went to his daughter, Janet Rochefort Ellerding, and his son, Joseph Rochefort Jr., U.S. Army, retired.
Thank you for listening. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please feel free to contact Amanda Williams at amanda.williams@norfolk.gov.